Could you first tell me, Mr. Michael Veery, where and when you were born?
October the 12th, 1912.
And where was that?
In London.
What were the names of your parents?
Henry Edward Veery, called Hal, and Lucy Alice Veery, and her name was Lucy.
What was your father's profession?
He was a solicitor.
Did your family have any connections with the city?
No, only my father had a fair number of friends in the city, but no business connections of any sort.
What area was he practising in?
He was practising really in the family area, not some companies, smaller private companies, but he was really family trusts and family affairs.
Where were you educated?
At Eton and Trinity.
And did you have any plans for your life while you were at school or as you were coming to the end of your...
No, not at school. I didn't have any plans, but one had to make plans at Cambridge. And I was a younger son and not at all well off. And I was out to make some money.
What had you read at Cambridge?
I read, first of all, 2 years on languages and 1 year law.
So how did you proceed when you were... You'd finished it?
Well, whilst we were all talking in our last year about jobs at Cambridge, I'm speaking of 1934, and I spoke to my father about it and made it quite clear that I wanted to go into something where I had the chance of making a million. And he said, in that case, I will speak to my old friend Alfred Wagg. And Alfred Wagg and my father were lifelong friends. They'd gone to a private school on the same day, to Eton on the same day, and to Cambridge on the same day. And as a result of that, Alfred Wagg asked us to dinner, a very alarming occasion. And a few days later, I got a letter to say that they would take me on at £86 a year.
Now, what kind of business was...
Helbert Wagg was, in terms of numbers, that is to say, the staff when I joined was probably about 80 or 90, a small, as far as size was concerned, merchant bank, but was rapidly becoming the most influential. You see, Rothschilds had really... post-war almost disappeared from the scene and were doing nothing. Barings wouldn't do equities. Hambros were really going for banking. Morgan Grenfell were active. And Lazard's up to a point, but Helbert Wagg very much was to the fore in both takeovers and mergers and investment, because we created, because of the determination of one of the partners, Alan Russell, the first corporate finance department in a merchant bank in the City of London. So we had a huge advantage in that instead of the partners doing the business off the top of their heads, we actually had a department with a chartered accountant at the head of it and another chartered accountant under him. And that gave us a lead, which the others all copied in due course. But we were in the lead. And so when people like IBM were coming to England and Heinz, they turned to us as the most go-ahead and the best.
About when did the corporate... finance.
That was immediately after the war that was started. I would have said by 1946.
How would you describe the bank at the time that you joined it?
It was an investment bank. We didn't do loans other than on the most special occasions. Of course, we did loans, but we weren't out to lend money. It was only if very good friends, be they personal or a business, came and asked for money that we were prepared to do any banking. We were doing investment business increasingly and issue business. And when I went, the foreign loan business had more or less dried up. But we were starting to do debentures. We put together the British Sugar Corporation in 1934, which was a combination of beet companies in Norfolk and Suffolk, all of which were owned by the Dutch. And it was part of hidden government policy in case of war to make us independent, or more independent, of having to get sugar shipped from the Indies. And so the British Sugar Corporation, Beet Sugar, was formed and was a public corporation. And then the last year or two, of course, it was winding down and clearing up everything because the partners quite rightly realized there was going to be a war and we must batten down the hatches. And then we opened up again in 1945, 46. And very quickly went for pension fund business. Again, it was under Alan Russell's propulsion. He'd been over to America, where they were ahead of us, had started the pension fund business before the war, which Helbert Wagg was the first group life pension scheme in the United Kingdom, done very reluctantly by the PRU. But Alfred said to the chairman, the then chairman of the PRU, that if he wouldn't do it, we'd go to the Pearl. The PRU didn't realize, hadn't a clue, that this was going to be the mainstay of their business for the future. So we went out for pension fund business, getting rid of private clients, offloading them wherever we possibly could, and only doing private clients closely connected with the firm, that would say partners and their families and the employees, but trying to get rid of everybody else, all the dukes and duchesses and things that we had, and going for pension schemes, because they were going to increase every year, whereas one death in the family and a perfectly good estate of 2 million quid was halved or worse, and then divided up between 8 children. So we thought that was a hopeless business and went for pension scheme, and were fortunate. We had a very good investment reputation. We were fortunate in getting the BBC, which we've had ever since. And of course, this was a very prestigious thing to get. The amount of money will make you laugh. It was £224,000 when it started, about 1946, I think, or seven. Is now several hundred million. And we became very powerful in any form of placing, because if there was a large placing, we, for our spread of interest, could take more than any other merchant bank.
What was your position in the bank at this stage?
Well, I was in the dealing department for a period before the war. One did everything. One did coupons, messenger. I did everything that, bar cleaning the lavatories and running the lift, that there was to do in the business. And then I was put into the investment department, which consisted of two people, and then into the dealing room, where we did the actual buying and selling for both foreign exchange and stocks and shares. And then post-war, investments again. And I then became head of the investment department, if you could call it a department, two men and a boy. Now there are dozens and dozens of them. And then I became a partner and went on. We combined the investment management and placing of shares together so that if Bearings or one of the other houses had a placing, I was the person who said yes or no and what we would take. And equally, it fell to me in the last resort to say, we think Shell is a very good investment and everybody ought to have some Shell. And then the chaps got on with it. Mm-hmm. And then I got involved because of that situation in the pricing of issues, so that if we were going to place whatever it might be, great chunk of something. I was involved, very much involved in the pricing, because I was in touch with lots of stockbrokers, not jobbers, occasionally jobbers, but and so it fell to me to do, in degree, the selection of stocks for investment and the management of the thing, how much in equities, because we were great equity people, but nevertheless everybody wanted a bit of gilt edge because they were frightened. They thought they, at a meeting, it looked solider to have a bit in gilt edge. Of course, it was awfully, on the whole, it was wrong. So I was involved in pricing and placing and investment, and was madly busy for 30 years. Then I gradually went up the ladder as people fell off it.
Can I cast your mind back a little bit to the pre-war and ask you how the actual dealing side of Helbert Wagg was organised?
Well, we dealt entirely through brokers, and we had a board, the first board in London, with about 20 buttons on it, and button A went straight through to Roan Pitman, and one of us, could be me, would say to Jay, who was the head dealer, if he happened at Roan Pitman, if he happened to answer the telephone, what's ICI, and he would say, and we'd say buy or sell or whatever it was, and then he'd come back and say done or not done, or I couldn't do it. So we dealt entirely through brokers. Lots of brokers we dealt with, but there were about Roan Pitman and Kasnev and Pamela Gordon and a few others got the guts of the business.
What was the advantage in dealing through several brokers rather than...
Well, we only would deal one stock through one broker if there was an order. We wouldn't split an ICI selling order amongst half a dozen brokers. We'd just go to one broker. Well, it was partly historic that we were friends, and also they brought us business. They would bring us, Pamela Gordon would bring us an issue, some debenture issue. Well, then we had to reciprocate. They got two-thirds of the brokerage, and we got a third return. And all sorts of firms brought us business. Capel Cure brought us a tremendous lot of business. They had an arrangement with the NatWest Bank. For many, many years. And anything that NatWest Bank had got, they took to Capel Cure. I think there'd been a bit of this and that somewhere. And Capel Cure brought it straight round to us. So naturally, if we'd got some fat orders for pension funds or whoever it might be, we gave some orders to Capel Cure. Mm. It was a back-scratching affair, there's no question about it. But at the end of the day, Casanova and Roan Pitman got more business than anybody else. Of course, we were very badly paid in those days. One got, for a new issue, you probably at the best got 0.5% of whatever it was. Well, then there would be a huge turnover if it was any good in the stocks and shares, and the broker would make four times what the issuing house made. It was really a scandal. That we frequently had created the whole business. And done it, and fees were very modest. I mean, the terrific row with Tube Investments, I mean, I'm speaking about 1957 or 8, I mean, the biggest city row there's ever been, all we got was £25,000. Sounded quite a lot of money in those days, but the brokers had turned over, Pamela Gordon and Seabags had turned over Tube Investment shares, British Aluminium shares, probably three times, and would have made, with no risk at all to reputation or anything whatever, they'd probably made three or four times what we'd made.
Who would be making the decisions about what investments to make with clients' money, again, well, during the earlier period?
In the earlier period, it was nearly always a partner involved, one of the Helbert Wagg partners. All of whom knew about investments. Some were better, cleverer, better than others, or luckier than others. It was probably a partner and a senior clerk. And then when it became bigger and really unmanageable in that way, then it became a department, and it was someone like myself later on, Bobby Holland and Ashley Ponsonby, who became partners, and later on Gordon Popham, who became a partner. It very seldom got delegated much below a partner. There were assistant directors, and they had later on, they had, but that was much later on, they had a fair run, but for a long time it was a partner who settled whether the thing should be bought or sold, because there was always a feeling of responsibility that it was a partnership within a company, and it was partners to be responsible and not to offload the thing onto however good senior clerks.
What would they base the decisions on? Did they get much
advice from a good deal of, it wasn't exactly insider trading, but it was pretty close to it. Kit Hoare, who was the head of Hoare & Co., he would have dinner with the investment manager of the Prue, and the investment manager of the Prue after dinner probably let a few secrets go that he, the Prue, had been told about this, that and the other. So Kit Hoare went round to his friends the next day and said, I think probably ICI or whatever it might be is a jolly good buy at this price. A great deal of word of mouthing. I think that people were fairly scrupulous when they knew facts, like if we knew, because we'd advised it and seen members of the board, that a dividend was going up, from very early stages we would not but then buy or sell the shares until that news was out. But other people were nothing like as scrupulous. We started that a stop list very early on, that once it was known as a fact, If it was in the balance, you could take your choice, buy or sell or do what you like. But the moment it was a fact, we had a stop list, which we were very severe about. But a lot of people weren't. And there was a good deal of directors in clubs with their friends, stockbrokers, and oh, we're doing jolly well at so-and-so. You know, there were a good deal of that. So that this all percolated through stockbrokers to Helbert Wagg. We had our own feeling, our own sort of feelers out, because we were in touch with an awful lot of companies, industrial companies. You see, we chucked doing foreign loans by 1930 and went out for industry, and two or three partners were on the move the whole time, going to Birmingham, Middlesbrough, Glasgow, Edinburgh, to drum up and get business. And so we got a lot of industrial business, Reynolds Chain, paper people, and we'd think, well, they're jolly good reeds in the old days. So we rather stuck to favourites, you see, where we knew the business, knew the chairman, and you got a sort of general impression of a thundering good business.
Do you have any recollections, what the expectations of your the clients who you were doing investment business?
No, they hadn't got a clue, you know. You see, the boards suddenly all woke up the fact they had to have a pension fund. They were doing nuts, screws and bolts or whatever. They hadn't the slightest idea about investments, and if they did have any ideas, they were usually very foolish. Their wife's mother had an aunt who had a friend who needed some money, of course, and that was about. So it was usually delegated to a secretary, the secretary of the company, who probably also knew nothing about pension funds or yields or returns or what was good, bad or indifferent. And if the board looked at the results once a year, you were lucky. And if they took 10 minutes in looking at the results, you were luckier still. And you appeared once a year and said what you'd done. And each year they had to put in more money, and you were then dismissed and the fee agreed and you went on for another year. But boards were, I mean, we dealt with a large number. As time went by, of course, the boards became more professional, the pension fund became bigger, And so they would have a sort of grand inquest meeting. The last time I did the BBC, I suppose, was 20 years ago, and it would be different now. But at the end of rather a long, full directors meeting of the BBC, a sort of £100 million fund, mm-hmm. we were dismissed with thanks inside of 6 minutes flat, you know, mm-hmm. a cup of tea and be gone, and reappointed for the following year.
What did they want? Did they want long-term growth? Did they want...
They didn't know what they wanted, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. I think, you see, I've been out of it now for a good many, a fair number of years, but at the time they didn't know what they wanted. They didn't really begin to apply their minds to the problem. What they liked to look at in the very short time that we were given, they liked to see that all the prices had gone up. And they would always pick on anything which had gone down and say, why is this, or, you know, might pick on something that had gone down. And then they would look at the overall return, and usually they were, got very few comments, we usually produced a good return, and that was it. But nowadays, you see, all the investment advisors are forced into this performance business. How have you performed against the indices, or this, that, and the other? And the difficulty is, I think, that if there is short-termism, it is enforced by the board of the company by asking for performance, saying, well, you know, you'll be judged against these things. Well, then instantly you get short-termism. But the fault lies, in my view, with the management of the company concern, not the investment advisors, because they will do whatever they're told to do. And if they're told, you know, maximum performance, that is another word for short-termism. If, on the other hand, they're told we take a long view and we don't want you to take short-term views and we're not going to judge you against an index, we will judge you over 10 years, 7 years, something like that, but we are not going to judge you every 6 months or every year. And we want you to take long views on all the things you do, and then we meet again in 7 years' time or see how you've done in between. But it's the present thing is the largely it's the companies blame the investment advisors for short-termism, but that's what they've asked of their investment advisors. And they can't see it. And then they all bellyache and say, the city, putting the good, bad and indifferent in the city. I mean, there's never been such a thing as the city. There are sections of the city. There's the top end of the city, which has been badly let down by Morgan Grenfell and one or two others recently. But there is still the top end of the city. Then there's a big wodge in the middle. And then there is the scum at the bottom. But there's no such thing as the city anymore. There was.
When you say was?
Well, I think about once people started playing ducks and drakes with the panel, that is, I suppose, about 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, we had to have the panel or equivalent. There's no doubt about that, and it's worked pretty well. And then people started to try and bend panel rules. And people got, of course, the fees went up. The fees became enormous. And so the prize for winning became terrific. And there was really a huge difference between a winning fee and a losing fee. And as the fees went up, so the honey attracted a lot more bees. And some of them were dubious. And some of the partners were, I mean, they got promoted because they were very clever. but they weren't very desirable people. And the standards went down. And the short-termism was all on this performance. Everybody had to perform at once or yesterday.
So I take it from what you've said that in the earlier days of Helbert Wagg, you were largely left yourselves in terms of the decisions you made about an investment. Did you find that you were turning over portfolios?
No, not at all. No churning. We stuck to things, many things we'd have without taking up rights issues, buying a bit more, but have the same thing 15 years later or 20 years later. No churning.
As a young man in the dealing room or the dealing department, was it a very busy place?
Unless, you know, we suddenly ran into some slump for some reason. I mean, the sort of 2 days before a socialist budget, there wasn't much business. But otherwise, I don't think it was deliberate, but because we were always getting more business, Helbert Wagg was always understaffed. There were never quite enough people. So we were all crammed together in a small but very nice office. On the whole, we were very well treated. Bonuses and holidays. And we led the field on holidays, that in the days when people were lucky to get a fortnight, we all got 3 weeks plus a week in the winter. So it was, everybody knew everybody, and the telephones were buzzing all the time, unless there was suddenly, for some reason, a fright of war or something or other, you know, and for a few days there was nothing doing.
What kind of background did the people working in the dealing room come from?
Oh, absolutely anything. One had been an RA in the RAF during the war. One had been secondary school boy. Turnham and Gordon, they were there for years. George Wood, I suppose, who was the best known figure in the City of London without a title, because we didn't have, in those days, assistant directors or anything like that. You were either a partner or you weren't. Secondary schools, leaving school on the whole at 16. Lionel Fraser, our chairman, you see, was a secondary school boy, left school at 16, went to night classes to teach himself French. We were a totally mixed up bunch from the point of view of background and education, from the best public schools down to the least known East End school.
Now, did you have much conception of what was going on at the other end of the dealing chain, in the stock exchange?
Yes, I think we did. We knew an awful lot of stockbrokers, and one was asked out to lunch a great deal by stockbrokers. So one knew pretty well. I worked for 3 months with Rowan Pittman in their box in the stock exchange.
When was that?
Oh, no, that would have been just post-war. 19, when Jay and Downer were the two leading dealers for Rowan Pittman. I think that was probably 1946.
What kind of things were you doing?
Well, I was really just dogs-bodying for them. I couldn't go into the stock exchange itself because I wasn't authorised, but in their box all the operations were taking place that they were buying and selling and doing. And it was quite good fun.
Was it a different atmosphere to what you'd known?
Well, they were immensely friendly. Of course, they were very well disposed towards Helbert Wagg, and they knew I came from Helbert Wagg, so they showed me everything. They knew I was trustworthy. You know, whether it was the silly old Duchess of this or the Prue or whatever it might be. They were completely open, so I knew exactly what they were doing and which of their own partners they liked or didn't like and who came into the box. And I didn't do much work, but one observed what was going on.
Did you have any conception of what was going on in the house, what the jobs were doing?
Well, yes, they would. Jay and Downer would explain that there was a tremendous scurry around the oil jobbers. They couldn't get near them, and it was ridiculous, and this, that, and the other. Because at times, if there was a particular thing on, then it was a crowded, more or less shouting market. But generally speaking, it was calm, very well behaved and regulated, and particularly on the Gilt Edge side. But every now and again, there'd be a kerfuffle.
Now, you've already referred to the importance that was placed on the pension fund business immediately yeah. after the war. Were you doing much institutional work before the war?
Not a lot, is that because there weren't the institutions to act for. We did a certain amount for insurance companies before the war. And, of course, we developed that post-war as well. Charities, pension funds and insurance we went for. And we had a director, you see, Bernie Barrington was for many years chairman of the Legal and General. Alfred was on the Provident and Mutual. I was on the Northern Assurance, which subsequently became Commercial Union. Ashley was on the Employers Liability. Bobby Holland was on the Commercial Union. Charles Villers was on the Sun Life. All of us on the investment committees of those insurance companies. So we heard, of course, what they were doing and up to and knew the form when it came to placing something.